Welcome to the Transcontinental Race Podcast, Finding Its Way with Komoot, the home of those who go further. Komoot's the ultimate route planner and navigation app that helps you explore more.
The clock is ticking and everybody around you is rushing. It's going to be a competition for everybody.
The Transcontinental is a single-stage bike race across Europe, and the clock never stops.
It's all rush, rush, rush with these people, honestly. Have a nice time.
The riders only take what they can carry.
Everyone's really interested in how other people have set up their bikes to sort of optimise carrying the load that they're carrying.
I need to do something. It's too heavy.
Absolutely.
But this is too heavy too, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the riders choose when and where to rest.
So we got a BV bag and a sleeping bag, so we can sleep everywhere we want.
I would find a restaurant. It looked like it had comfortable cushions. I would eat. I would ask the waiters or the waitress if I could just nap there, and nobody ever turned me down in my full-on bike gear.
It's around 4,000 kilometers from the start line in Burgas in Bulgaria to the finish line in Brest, France. And it's down to the riders to plan, research, and navigate their own course to get there. But there are four mandatory stops along the way that are called control points, and they mean the riders won't be taking the most direct route. The control points ensure a healthy amount of climbing to reach some of cycling's most beautiful and historic monuments. This year, the ride begins in Burgas on the west coast of the Black Sea, a body of water that on the map resembles the skeletal shape of human hip bones. Just 300 kilometers west is the Turkish capital, Istanbul. Head 300 kilometers north and you reach Bucharest, Romania's capital. Greece is to the south, and to the east, on the opposite side of the Black Sea, the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, sits just back from the coast. But our riders are heading west. They set off from a monument commemorating fallen anti-fascist fighters, and until the end of socialist rule in 1989, there was a fire that burned continuously in the centre. Whereas last year the race began in the evening, this year the riders set off at 6 a.m, and with the first control point just 220 kilometres from the start, they'll be rolling into control point one through the afternoon and into the evening. Our rendezvous point is high in the Bulgarian mountains, at the abandoned memorial house of the Bulgarian Communist Party. Atop Buzluja Peak, it looks like an alien spacecraft. Behind it, a column rises into the sky with a huge red communist star at the top. When it was built in 1981, it was said that when the star was lit up, it could be seen from Greece and Romania. It's an imposing, futuristic building, designed to be more impressive than the Colosseum in Rome and to serve as a shrine to socialism. But since the country's transition to democracy, it's been left to rot. I'll be talking more about the history of the building in the next episode, but first, let's hear more about this year's controls from Transcontinental Race Director Anna Haslock.
This year we're starting at the Pantheon in Burgas. We've got an escorted, neutralised section. The local police are taking us out of the city, so we'll do that in a peloton. And then they will be turning off the main road and heading out towards the start parkours, which is a mandatory section of the race. So most of the race is not mandatory, as in, you know, there is no set course. But we have these sections, which are usually very close or attached to the control points, which are mandatory. And we've specifically chosen these to shape the race, to give the riders a certain challenge, or to deliver some spectacular scenery. The parkours for control point one this year starts at the bottom of Buzluja, and they'll be asked to make that climb up to the monument. This year they're also having a sort of celebration, celebrating communism and the Communist Party. That will be happening on the very day we arrive, which is exciting. So that's going on as well. That's really the start of that parkour. That's quite a long parkour, so they'll be then required to climb that peak, and then they'll be asked to take the final climb of the parkours up to the second communist monument of the CP1, which is the Arch of Freedom. After that, they head towards the second control point, which is based in the south of Serbia. That parkour is about 90 kilometres of gravel. But it's, you know, for people who've chosen to ride on skinny tyres this year, they might not enjoy it so much, let's see.
The bikes and their riders have been arriving at Burgas Airport.
Oh my goodness, it's arrived! Look at that piece of kit! I genuinely didn't expect it to come out in one piece.
And at registration, I was enjoying seeing everyone size each other's bikes up.
Have you seen the paint on this?
Isn't this the prettiest bike? I think this is the prettiest bike so far.
That's what I'm going for, yeah, because yeah. I don't think I can do anything better than that.
Win the prettiest bike!
Can you tell me about the colour scheme and like why you chose it?
The colour scheme is influenced by the 80s. So if you think 80s or like Albano, you know, Romina Power, that's exactly what it is.
It's definitely got that nice pastel thing going on. It looks beautiful.
Thank you.
How are you feeling about the ride in general?
Pretty good, actually. It's been, you know, a long time planned event to do and just finally doing it. So that's it. We'll see how it goes, but feeling pretty confident. I know I'm not the fastest one, but I should be fine, you know, to do it in 15 days and keep going.
How are you doing?
Excellent. I'm worried though. Worried as hell.
What things are worrying you now?
It's my first time. Finding enough food, finding a place to sleep, the dogs, I don't know, yeah. I think I trained well, I prepared well, the bike is okay, and the route I think is okay, but yeah. Finding food and sleep and enjoy the ride. I think that's the main part of my strategy. And try to ride 275 a day to be on time for the party, no? So that's it. Simple.
The bikes are everywhere. They're lent on birch trees, they're rested against benches, they're on the steps of the Pantheon. And there's a lot of talk about tyre choice for that gravel section.
Last year, René Bon ridiculed me for running on gator skins, laughing at how slow they would roll. So this year I've gone with some GP5000s. They're in a clincher, but it's much easier to fix any problems, but can't get anything bigger than 28s on, which I'm a bit nervous about. So hopefully, keep fingers crossed for the guys running on the skinny tyres, because I'm a little bit worried about all the gravel that's to come. Hopefully they hold together.
At the moment, I'm happy with my choices. Yeah, I mean, we always knew there was going to be a range of like narrow tyres and fat tyres, and that's probably the biggest difference between my setup and other people's. Mine are fat, but having like the fatter tyres is just going to give me a whole ton of confidence. You wait, there'll be like a wobble at the start and then all that confidence will go out the window as well. But hopefully that won't happen. So yeah, it's confidence as much as anything. Based on training, the back one will probably be pretty bald by the time we get to France anyway. So it'll be like a slick anyway. So it's a win-win.
So you've kept the tyres the same for the gravel?
No, well, that's the only difference I used this year. 32mm 25,000 on it instead of just 28mm.
And have you been riding with them since you put them on roads as well?
Yeah, of course. I'm riding on them since quite a while since, yeah. Pretty much the same.
That was Chris Thomas, Rachel Batt and Bjorn Lennart. Bjorn is one of the favourites to win the Transcontinental race this year. He's a legend of the scene, but relatively, he's not been racing very long.
I'm doing road cycling now since 8 years.
His story's quite incredible. He came third last year in the Transcontinental race and second the year before. He won the Transatlantic Way in 2017 and 2018, finishing in 6 days, 1 hour and 24 minutes the first time. And then last year he knocked 21 hours and 55 minutes off that for his second win to cover 2,500 kilometres in 5 days, 3 hours and 51 minutes. I caught up with Bjorn a couple of weeks before the race, and I have to apologise for the terrible line that we had that I'll generously describe as textured. Because of that, I'll need to summarise a little. Bjorn told me that he got into long distance riding when he and his wife had booked a holiday north of Berlin, but she ended up having to work for the first day of the break.
Somehow I got this strange idea, well, I can cycle up there in the morning, start there, and if I can't make it, she can catch me up with a car. And actually, I didn't have a road bike at this time, so I took my mountain bike, put some road tires on.
It was about 330 kilometers from his home in Dresden.
I really enjoyed it. I really had fun on this day. It was just a great day for me.
Bjorn got into the Audax scene and rode 200 kilometres, 300 kilometres and 400 kilometre distances, and he was hooked. He rode a few longer races, and then in 2015 he rode Paris-Brest-Paris, 1,200 kilometres.
Up to there it was my absolutely longest ride.
So the man who did his first long distance ride in 2010 and bought his first road bike in 2011 entered Paris-Brest-Paris in 2015. And he didn't just finish it. He was the first person across the finish line that year and became the fastest amateur rider ever to complete it.
My plan was just, you know, to keep in the top group and maybe to finish it also in this group. But I wouldn't imagine that it could be happened that I could do it on my own, really, for 700 kilometers. But, well, finally it ended up, you know.
In last year's TCR, he and James Hayden swapped between first and second place in a game of cat and mouse that went on until Bjorn had a disastrous 24 hours on the way to the third control point on the Czech-Poland border.
I run out of food and drinks. Then you see something. Oh, you can pay with coins, but not with euro. Not with Visa. And then I think it was six or so. I was completely dead.
Oh,
I was sitting there, it was... I could have stopped crying. This was the next step, you know? It was just right in front of it.
I could totally feel you right now.
You know, I was sitting there. I mean, I was still in first position, you know? But it's...
I know. Oh, God.
And then, you know, I had a quick phone call with my girlfriend and I decided, well, I need something to eat now and something to sleep. This was just, what can I do now?
Oh gosh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, sorry.
It's gonna get better. It's gonna get better. I'll get you some food.
That's life, yeah. Let's see if they have some cake at the end.
They've got something for sure. At least it's all downhill from here. Yeah. You have a long downhill.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
You get to go back down the hill, don't you? You had a puncture.
Oh, no.
Oh,
I managed to cut off the sidewall.
No. When did that happen? Just now? On the
2 kilometers away from here.
You can listen back to the full story on our podcast from TCR number 6, called Moments of Despair. At registration this year, with his sparring partner James Hayden not racing this time around, I asked Bjorn what his hopes were for the race.
How you doing?
Thanks.
Good. Nice to see you.
Yeah, me too.
Have you got a plan?
Finish.
Always the plan, finish.
Yeah, of course. But yeah. Have some fun and have a good adventure. It's most important.
I think the first two controls probably pose the big question, don't they? It's just how you decide to do that.
Well, the first one, I mean, this would be tomorrow at the day and, well, CB2 and on Sunday, I guess. It depends how the Saturday goes tomorrow, how I'm getting on, and because I don't want to drive through Sofia on the day, so because of the traffic, so it would be good to do it tomorrow night maybe. It depends a bit. Also how I feel. I mean, if I feel really tired, then maybe I have a short nap or so. If not, I might go through. We'll see. I'm going to ride from the morning till the midnight or something like this. Whatever it goes. But to really say, okay, I'm going to ride from here to there on one specific day, this is impossible almost.
It's a long journey from putting in your application to the start line. This year, a rider we'll be keeping a close eye on is Johnny Rankin. Last year, he rode in the pairs category before he and his partner James Craven had to split when James came down with suspected pneumonia. After waiting with James a while, Johnny rode on and was a 10th rider to cross the line. Though because he'd been in a pair and had all the advantages that come with that, he couldn't be included in the final rankings for solo riders. Before the race, Johnny told the story of how he got to the start line of TCR number 6. He and James had applied after stumbling across the race while touring in Bulgaria. But after applying twice unsuccessfully, they decided to try their luck as a pair. And thankfully for us, they got in. But getting out for bike rides to train wasn't easy.
Last year, I was living and working in Japan all through the kind of application process and the winter months before the race. I couldn't really train during the weekdays because it took so long to get out of the middle of Tokyo where I was living. It takes 4 hours until you're past the kind of stream of traffic lights. And so I would get up most mornings and do kind of a bit of circuit training. And then on a Friday night, I would pack a bag up and put it on the back of the bike, cycle off, and then it would get to about midnight by the time I got out of Tokyo. And I would sleep at the side of the road, and then I would wake up, ride all day Saturday, bivvy again, and then ride all day Sunday, and get back into the middle of Tokyo by Sunday evening. When I got back to the UK in May, I had a job lined up that was in Edinburgh, which started in June. And it gave me a month to kind of do a bit of cycling, get my head back into it. James and I did one big cycle ride, a sort of 650-odd-k route over a weekend, and we, I wouldn't say we raced it, but we like learned a lot from riding together, and we knew that we were roughly the same speed, and we knew how to get along well with each other. And then we just turned up at the start of the race in as best shape as we both could be in and went for it. I was really proud of how we did, and taking the experience into this year, I am very much of the opinion that on that start line, after you start, anything can go wrong, and it would be very difficult if you based everything on it going perfectly, because it's not going to go perfectly. And our race went it went perfectly up until James was ill, and he was ill. There was nothing we could do about it. You make a decision. I cycled on, and he took a bit of time to get, I'm going to say well again, but like he was, you know, he was not 100%. And we raced just separately as hard as we could to the finish, just in different ways. And when I tell people, like my grandma, for instance, she says, but you finished 10th. And I didn't finish because it was James and me. You know, I shouldn't get a finishing position because I didn't finish in the race. She says, no, but you did. And I said, no, I didn't. There's a very difference. There's a big difference in my head between starting as a pair and racing as a pair, starting as an individual and racing as an individual. And I think like that's something that, you know, for me, it's a race. You can kind of pick and choose the parts of the race that you want to believe in. It has to be, it's all or nothing.
This year, he's going it alone, and he's training every day on an exercise bike.
I'm trying to turn over all the stones to find out what's underneath them, or to find out what works for me. Crux of all of that is that I have structure to what I'm doing. So something that I have always avoided is like doing hard intervals, and I know there's a benefit to doing them. I just hate them, both for mental and physical reasons, and it's like forcing yourself to do those things in a consistent manner so that you can be packing your bike up knowing that you've done everything that you can do for the situation that you're in. I mean, it's something that James Hayden said last year when I was talking to him in the bar was, you know, yeah, it's better to do 30 minutes every day than it is to do 3.5 hours on a Sunday and do nothing else in between. And so I'm essentially doing that.
The nature of self-supported racing means just being fast on the bike isn't really enough. It's about everything in between too. Following the race, one of the things that I love is watching the riders reaching the shops that they've probably been thinking about for hours on the bike, and then they arrive, and some of them buy what they want with pit stop-like efficiency, and then at other times they just seem to do laps around the aisles, whirring and excited, indecisive circles. Jim Stewart and Rachel Batt, who we heard earlier talking about her tyres, rode the TCR for the first time last year as a pair. They put work into trying to streamline their stops.
Both of us quite like trying to do things as sort of efficiently and quickly as possible, even though I'm probably the biggest faffer and most indecisive person in the world. But we do like trying to do things quickly. So the idea of doing it like a tour where you've got a bit of pressure on you time-wise was quite, yeah, it was good, wasn't it?
Describing yourself as a big faffer, how did you find kind of acclimatising to riding as a pair, having to deal with each other's needs, but also get supplies and all of that?
I think we tried to practice as much as possible before TCR started, didn't we? So like we'd made ourselves a schedule for how we thought we would ride TCR. So we tried to practice that beforehand, and we tried to like make stops like maximum of 15 minutes and practice that. But the thing that we'd not really practiced very well was like who stays and looks after the bikes, and just silly things like that where you end up losing a bit of time because one of you would go into the shop, then the other one would go into the shop, and it just, I don't know. So that sort of thing, eventually on TCR, it ironed itself out, didn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think we just got a little bit less worried about leaving our bikes outside and just went in anyway. But the thing that slows you down is trying to decide what you want to eat. And when you go somewhere like a petrol station, there aren't a great deal of choices. So you just grab what you can and you eat it as quickly as you can and then you leave. The difficulty is when you get your phone out and you start looking at the tracker or you start messaging someone back or whatever. So I stopped messaging anyone. And they, all my family that had been messaging me started to message Rach instead. And I didn't hear it. It was the radio silence for me for the next 2 weeks, which was perfect for me.
Did you settle on buying the same thing each time almost when you went?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah, a big packet of crisps and a big packet of Oreos. And that was basically every petrol station stop involved those two. And then we'd buy like our own individual drinks that we wanted. But
what about sandwiches?
You can't always get sandwiches. So when you could get sandwiches, yeah, that was great. And that was like a treat. But the further east you go, the more petrol stations seem to become petrol stations. They sell petrol and they sell light bulbs for cars and they sell oil. They don't sell sandwiches. They sell some drinks and that's about it. So you get a bit less picky and you just eat what you can find. Whereas this time round, with it being the opposite direction, it's going to be starting like that, but then you're going to end up in France where there's nice boulangeries and patisseries full of sandwiches and bread and
yeah, with terrible opening hours.
Yeah. When you're riding most waking hours, day after day, going too far into your reserves one day is likely to mean a much slower one the next. I spoke to Mike Warren, a rider with Audax Club Bristol, who's racing this year, about how he's been judging what his body can take.
It's a very important thing, I think, to have a sort of internal gauge of how far you're emptying the tank. And I've definitely tried to really work on that because I was terrible at it before. I think I've done a few rides that are several days long and they've been very helpful and constructive for me in sort of teaching me just how uncomfortable it feels to overdo it and then find you've got a whole bunch more ahead of you. So I rode an end-to-end last November. I think that was the first long multi-day ride that I did where my only concern was getting on my bike and moving for no other reason than, as one person I met in a pub put it, I had apparently fallen out with myself. That was really useful to know that, okay, I can do this sort of distance and kind of still feel replenished enough to do the same again the next day. That sort of limit or that measure is definitely something that I hadn't really seen before, and it's something that I'll be relying on heavily. You know, if my race goes well, it will be because I've got a really good feel for how much I can do without sort of degrading my ability the next day.
Have you, when making your route, thought about how much distance you might cover in a particular day?
I've no idea whether my approach is the right approach, but I've tried to focus on having a strategy rather than a plan. Because I figure that so much can vary. You know, it could even be the difference between a weather forecast or wind direction or, you know, what I've eaten at some service station the previous day could have a huge effect on how things go. So rather than setting out daily distance targets, what I've done is chopped my planned route up into sections that are about 100-ish kilometres long. Give or take, and I've tried to make sure that at the end of each one of these sections is a town where I can eat, potentially sleep, maybe get my bike fixed, some kind of resupply. That way that I know I can focus on something that's a little further ahead than my front wheel, but not have to stare at some vast, impossible distance. But also, I can kind of know that I'm never more than 4 hours away from resupply at the end of each section. I can look at the next, whether it's feasible to get cracking on it now or whether I need to recharge a bit beforehand and do things like give myself a cue in my GPX file that tells me there's a 24-hour petrol station coming up. So I don't even need to stop and look at the sign. I can sort of see that coming. And a few other little things that, you know, in films where your future self comes to warn you about some terrible thing that's going to happen to you tomorrow. I kind of want to set it up so that my past self can go and give me a little push and help me along the way a couple of times.
It sounds like you're going to set some cues that have got key mantras in that will pop up at certain points in the route.
I don't think it's quite as philosophical as that. I'm not sure if a key mantra counts as you might find public toilets here. I don't know if that counts as a key mantra.
Of course, there are some situations when to stay competitive in the race, you have to dig deeper than you might have expected. Gabby Thompson is community manager for our sponsors Komoot and a rider for Cannondale. When she rode the Transcontinental in 2014, she and her partner ended up riding one of the most fearsome mountain passes in Italy, the Stelvio, in the snow, at night. And when they got to the top, they had to tear up their plan.
When you got to the top of the Stelvio, you had two options. So for us, we could either go down the coast to Croatia, or we could go down the Italian coast on the other side, which was like much flatter and like an easier route, whereas the Dalmatian coast is like really, really undulating and well known for having a pretty relentless headwind. But the only issue with if you went down the Italian side is you had to get a ferry crossing across to Croatia to then continue the route to Istanbul. But the ferry only went once a day. And when we were actually at the top of the Stelvio, there was going to be one more ferry that ran, and then it was going to be a bank holiday. So if you missed it, you were like really in trouble. And we'd always planned to go down the Dalmatian coast because we didn't want the pressure of having to get the ferry. But on the top of the Stelvio, we could hear lots of people talking about heading to the ferry and that there was still time and all of these kind of things. And then we just thought, oh, if we can make the ferry, it would be amazing. It would be like a much faster ride down that coastline. And then you get this kind of enforced rest on the ferry. You get across to Croatia, so you get a chance to hopefully like freshen up a bit, and then you can like start going again. So we decided to go for it, but we had absolutely no route. So we had to really like do a mix of kind of following our nose, using paper maps, using like any kind of online mapping we could find at the time. So it was really quite stressful trying to make sure that we were always like going the right direction with this like really intense time pressure. And also we didn't really have the time to plan that we were going to be on nice cycle friendly roads. So we were on a real mix of some really busy roads. Then we were on like a cycle path for a long time with quite mixed terrain and all of these kind of things. And in the end, it paid off and we did get the ferry. We were the last people on it. But our lovely sleep that we thought we were going to have didn't really happen because we'd actually got this kind of holiday party boat to Croatia that everyone had jumped on for the bank holiday. But yeah, it was definitely anyone behind us then was definitely in trouble having to wait for 2 days stranded on the Italian side.
It's spirited riding like that that makes the race so captivating. But the most important thing is that whatever decisions the riders take along the way, they need to be fair. The Transcontinental Race was the concept of Mike Hall. Mike was one of the leading ultra-distance cyclists in the world, and in his 35 years, he broke the record for cycling around the world west to east, finishing in 91 days, 18 hours, and averaging 200 miles a day. He twice won the Tour Divide mountain bike race across the Rocky Mountains, from Canada to the Mexican border. But in 2017, he was killed in a collision in Australia whilst riding in the India Pacific wheel race. He felt passionately about an individual's right to autonomy and the powerful, positive impact of adventure and self-discovery. When he came up with the concept for the race, he distilled all the rules down into a folded card called a brevet card that each rider is given at the start. Smaller than a birthday card when folded shut and just 90mm by 130mm, inside there are six square boxes which will be stamped at each control point if the riders arrive within the cutoff time. On the back, there are just 10 rules. Ride from the start line to the finish via the controls listed here. No third-party support, resupply, or lodgings. No drafting, other than with Pairs Partner. All forward travel must be self-powered. Travel by ferries, only on approved routes. All riders must maintain evidence of their ride. Inactive for two or more days without contact.
That's a scratch. You're out of the race. No insurance, no helmet, no lights. That's a scratch. Riders must know and obey local traffic laws. And finally, ride in the spirit of self-reliance and equal opportunity. I'll let Mike explain that one.
A race needs to have some rules. But for us, people like the fact that we can print all of the rules on the back of this Brevet card. Now, there are some difficulties with that because people being people often think, well, if it's not printed on this, I can do it. That isn't what this is about. One of the things about unsupported racing that makes it good to watch is that there are so many different factors there. The rule book can't capture all of the circumstances in a race like Transcontinental. We can't do that on a race that goes across an entire continent unless we go to the model which is like have a really big rule book. So you end up with police, rules, rule breakers and loopholes. And then because the racers don't think of the rules as being a person who's managing a fair situation, then they look for gaps in the rules and say, well, if the gap's there and if it's not explicitly expressed in the rules that I can't do X, Y and Z, then I'm going to do X, Y and Z. Now, in Transcontinental we do things a little bit differently because we have a kind of one that sums up, which I believe is one of the most important ones, ride in the spirit of self-reliant and equal opportunity. And what that does is that sets out what the rules are trying to do, which is saying be fair to each other. Go into the race with a feeling of I've got to be fair to the other people in this because that's how the judgment and interpretation of the rules is going to be levied at the end. So you have to use your judgment in fairness, and that is a huge amount of the spirit of the races. We want people to think about what's fair. That defines our community. That defines everybody who lines up on the start of the race together and they look at each other is, I'm going to be fair to you. You want to be able to look them in the eye, shake their hand and go, you and me, we're going to do this in the right way. And whatever happens, you know, we can say we did that. That for me is how we get 10 rules onto this card. And it's having a person who makes sense of them and who people trust to be fair to other people. They've got to create a sense of ethos and a sense of community around the race so everybody kind of gets a feel for that's trustworthy. And they need to be fair to people. That's what I try to do, and I take that very seriously.
As the riders set off, I want to thank you for listening to this first episode. I'm Tom Bonnet, and I'll be following the action, not always from the front of the race, but always from the heart of it, telling personal stories from the riders and giving you a guide to the landmarks and the landscapes that they'll be riding through. Next time, we'll be talking about the incredible abandoned monument at CP1, and I'll be talking to Jenny Tuff and introducing you to more riders that we'll be following along the way. Don't forget, you can dot watch the riders' progress on the Transcontinental website, and for analysis and updates on the sharp end of the Transcontinental, read our daily race reports and follow us on social media.